Hello, I'm Dan Jurgen, Vice Chairman of IHS Markit, and I want to welcome you to CERAWeek Conversations presented by IHS Markit. We're very pleased today to welcome to our conversation the Honorable Dan Brouillette, the United States Secretary of Energy. Secretary Brouillette, welcome.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be with you.
So, Mr. Secretary, in ways that people may not know, the DOE is actually quite involved in the COVID-19 crisis. Maybe you might just share with us what DOE is doing.
Sure. I'd be happy to, Dan. Yeah, the Department of Energy is, in many respects, a little-known agency. Everyone associates our name, obviously, with the production of energy, and, to each industry, it means something different, obviously, oil, gas, electricity. But we also have within our department 17 of the nation's laboratories, our national laboratories. And they are wonderful institutions that do a multitude of work, not only in the energy space, but really in about anything that you can think of. If you're familiar with the Human Genome Project, that started right here at the Department of Energy. And it was the expertise that we developed through those types of projects that allowed us to look at this particular virus and identify several strains of proteins that were nearly identical to previous viruses that we had seen. And we combined our biosecurity talent, our expertise with biological sciences, with our supercomputing capabilities at our Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee. Where we own actually the world's fastest supercomputer, we call it Summit. We're able to take the scientific expertise, apply artificial intelligence to many of the things that we had learned there, run it through our supercomputers, and literally within a matter of hours in some cases, identify drug compounds that would have a particular positive effect on this virus. And we shared that with the CDC. We shared that with Health and Human Services experts, as well as members of the Vice President's task force. So it was a very important contribution that the Department of Energy made. We were able to use all of the talents that we had within our department, compress the time frame, very importantly, from a matter of months, perhaps years in certain cases, to a matter of days. So it was very much appreciated by the entire task force. And that work is continuing as we speak.
Yeah, I was going to ask you with the national labs, do they continue to be engaged on this
They
front?
are. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, they are. I mean, as we identify additional drug compounds, I mean, you think about what's out there in the world today, literally billions of pages of literature and research, not only on the virus, but on the drugs that might be effective on the virus itself. And we're able to cull through all of this material in a matter of hours and pull out the most relevant pieces of data and share it with the task force so that they can make progress attacking this virus.
And more broadly, how has the DOE, with its very broad responsibilities, operated in this COVID era?
Well, I'm proud to say we haven't missed a beat. Part of the mission here at DOE is not only to do science, as we just discussed, and to look at technologies that might be of a certain might provide the U.S. industry with certain advantages in the marketplace. It's also to provide the nation with national security, and we do that through our weapons program here. The U.S. Department of Energy is responsible for stockpiling and stewardship of the nation's nuclear warhead program. So we design them, we manufacture them, we deliver them to the U.S. Navy. And at the end of their useful life, we dispose of them. And I'm proud to say that throughout this entire pandemic, we've not missed a single shipment. We've not been late with any requirement on the part of the DoD. So our employees have really stepped up and delivered the mail, if you will, throughout this entire pandemic exercise.
Are most of your people working from home now who can?
The vast majority of the employees are. We went to a maximum telework environment. So to the extent that you could work from home. We encouraged you to work from home so that you wouldn't potentially expose your colleagues throughout the building or throughout the complex. But of course, as we just discussed, it's very difficult to deliver a nuclear warhead to a submarine over the telephone.
Or by Zoom. Or by
Or by
Zoom.
Zoom.
Yes.
So some people are working day in and day out. Well, we're doing well, Dan. Thanks for asking.
And your people are, for the most part, well, I presume.
We are. We've been blessed with a very low exposure rate to the virus itself. As of today, I think our actual number of cases is somewhere south of 200. And that's in a complex that extends internationally and exceeds over 100,000 federal employees and contractors. So a very low exposure rate. We're very, very lucky.
Of course, you deal with those long-term issues, and then you deal with short-term issues, including the oil market, which has been one of the economic symptoms of the COVID crisis. There was the historic OPEC Plus agreement with the G20, with the U.S. very involved in mid-April. It was a key step in trying to stabilize the oil market. Can you tell us a little bit about how that actually came about?
Sure. Happy to. You're right. It's an extraordinary time frame, extraordinary period of history, I think. This conversation with the Saudis and the Russians began as part of their OPEC meetings, their regularly scheduled OPEC conversations. And I suppose at some point around the mid-February, late March timeframe, they reached a loggerheads. I mean, they began a dispute that they could not resolve. And as a result, they parted ways. They went separate ways and ended the conversation altogether. The next steps, I think, were absolutely critical. And what we saw was the Saudis in particular take two steps to address the situation as they saw it inside of OPEC. And that was to both announce an increase in their production and, importantly, a decrease in their price around the world. And this came right about the time that the world began to realize that the pandemic was taking hold and nations were going to have to address this pandemic in a very aggressive way. And what that meant was closing their economies. So we had a situation in which the Saudis were increasing production, decreasing price, and demand was falling off the end of the table. Just an extraordinary time period. And as we saw this unfold, we saw that the impact would be obviously on, parts of the world, Russia and Saudi, as particular players here, but it would also impact the U.S. oil production industry. And as a result, the president directed me to begin a conversation with my counterparts in both Saudi Arabia and Russia, which I did immediately. And in the context of those conversations, it became clear that it wasn't going to be resolved purely at the administrative or at the ministerial level. We engaged in really good dialogue. Obviously, we're not, as the United States, part of OPEC, so our participation initially was at the margin. But I was able to convince the parties to agree to a G20 conversation. And fortunately, the Saudis are chairing the G20 this year, so it was a very good conversation. And that allowed many other nations to come to the table and understand the situation more fully and to begin a discussion about what was happening in our respective markets. But all throughout this process, it became clear that we were going to have to reduce production. Nations were going to reduce production. And for some nations who are cartel members, that meant that they were going to agree to cuts within the context of OPEC or OPEC Plus. But for those of us who are, G20 nations in free markets, we were able to explain to the parties engaged that, our production was going to go down as well, simply as a matter of market demand falling off. But it was important that we all have this conversation together so that we could understand the impact of our individual actions and what was going to be not only the short term situation, but what was going to be the recovery plan as well. And, we can talk about that because I do think it's going to be very bright on the other side of this pandemic.
So we'll come back to the recovery plan. Obviously, the president himself, as you said, this needed to be resolved above the ministerial level, and the president himself became quite engaged.
He did. As I mentioned, it was, clear that we could do a lot of work at the ministerial level and, have a number of detailed conversations about what was happening in the marketplace and what our thoughts were around those events. But at the end of the day, if there was to be a deal, it was really going to be at the head of state level. And the president really stepped up to the plate and does what he does so well, and that was to bring parties together and agree to these production levels that you now see as part of the agreement. He engaged directly with President Putin. He was able to convene calls with President Putin and the King of Saudi Arabia at the same time. And that was really the key to bringing this conversation to a close. And I think it speaks to the situation that we faced here in America. I mean, I can't imagine this happening in 1973 or 1974, you know, when the United States was an importing nation and not an exporting nation. The fact that our energy situation, our energy industry had turned around so dramatically in these 3 or 4 decades, I think allowed our president, allowed our country to be a bigger player, a bigger part of these international conversations.
Well, I guess what it also demonstrated is that the U.S. Was now central, really, to the world oil market in a way that we hadn't been for many decades.
That's correct. I mean, up until, you know, the early part of March, I suppose, we were not only the world's largest economy, but we're also the world's largest oil and gas producer. Yeah. And that's a very unique situation for the United States to be in, at least in my lifetime. There may have been periods in American history where we had both the largest economy, the largest demand curve, as well as, you know, being a very large producer of energy. But for the last few decades, it's not been that way. We've had the largest economy.
For the last many decades, actually.
For the last many decades, yeah. It's not been that way. We've had a very large economy, but we've not been able to produce enough energy to satisfy our own needs here within our geographic borders.
So we'll come back to that because that's, your view of how it will develop in the future. It was striking. Today, I was just looking at our own numbers as to when did U.S. gasoline consumption reach the lowest level in terms of percentage drop. And it happened to be April 11th, which was almost exactly the day that the deal was made, just by coincidence.
But is that right? Wow.
It just shows how dire the situation was at that point.
It really was.
Any thoughts on compliance among people pledging cutbacks and, you know, what you think the, shall we say, the social pressure on them is?
Well, I think the situation is quite unique. I mean, in the past where you may have had an agreement amongst cartel members to honor certain agreements or certain production numbers, here we have both that agreement and a situation in the market that really doesn't allow non-compliance in many respects. You know, we have a decreased demand curve, as you just mentioned, and as we've talked about. You also have, you know, this increasing pressure on storage around the world. As demand has fallen off and production, you know, is beginning to fall off, but the production curves are somewhat slower than the demand curves in this case, we're facing enormous pressures on storage. So as a result, I don't think players have many options. So if you're an OPEC or an OPEC Plus member and you're thinking about not honoring the agreement, I'm not quite sure where you're going to put the oil because right. There's no market to send it to and there's no storage available for you. So I think it's a very unique situation in that regard.
How does the storage situation look to you globally?
Well, it's filling up very fast. I mean, as we read in the papers, I suppose that, you know, the number I've seen quoted most often is we're about 85% or so full with regard to worldwide storage. And the remaining 15% or so is, it looks like it may be available on paper, but it's actually contracted for certain players. So if you happen to own one of those contracts, I suppose you're in the catbird seat these days. But, you know, storage is very, very tight all around the world.
Yeah, I mean, storage has gone from being a logistical tool to being a prized commodity right now in terms of.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. You know, one of the policy options we pursued here within the department, we own the Strategic Petroleum Reserve here within the U.S. Department of Energy. And we realized very, very quickly that the storage was perhaps at times more valuable than the commodity itself.
Right. Well, let's talk about the SPR because, you know, the simplest thing that you could have done was just simply buy oil and put it into the SPR, which would have been a good deal for the federal treasury, but that hasn't happened. So you had 77 million barrels of capacity available. How have you tried to deal with it?
Well, what we've done is we've opened up the storage for use by the private industry, and we're charging rent essentially for using the strategic reserve. So rather than going out and buy oil in this case or charging people rent and having them pay in cash, they pay in oil. So as a result, we're filling the SPRO, we're filling the strategic reserve, and we're doing it at the best price available. And, you know, for the taxpayer, that's a really, really good deal because we're going to fill it up at some point in the future, not for free, but essentially for free at a very low price.
So just for those who, you know, rent, do you charge on a monthly or an annual basis?
We charge them as it comes in. So
it's,
As soon as you hit the door, you write us a check or you give us some oil. So
right. I'll come back to the U.S. in a second, but just one more international thing. I mean, both the countries you talk about, Saudi Arabia and Russia, of course, have large sovereign wealth funds. Some of the oil exporters, whether they're in OPEC or don't have large sovereign wealth funds or really have no sovereign wealth funds. What kind of concern is there or that you have about some of those countries in terms of the difficulties they'll have when their revenues have been cut so dramatically?
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to place enormous economic pressure on these countries, obviously. What it means in terms of their compliance with the agreements, if they're a part of OPEC or a part of OPEC Plus, I think remains to be seen. It really depends on how fast the economies turn around. And I think, you know, that's what we're focused on right at the moment. Here in the United States, we're beginning to open up our economy. I think over half of our states now have some measures in place to allow, you know, some increased economic activity. If that happens over the course of the next 2, 3, 4, 5 months in a more aggressive way, then I think obviously the economic pain faced by these countries that don't have sovereign wealth funds will be eased, you know, it'll be minimized or mitigated, I should say. So we'll have to wait and see. We'll just have to wait and see how fast China comes back online, how fast Europe comes back online, and certainly how fast the United States comes back online.
Well, you talked about, of course, the U.S. industry, and ironically, I think it reached its highest point ever in February of this year, 13 million barrels a day, according to the DOE and EIA, and then came the crisis. We were virtually on the edge of energy independence. How do you see the state of the industry in the middle of this corona crisis today?
Well, there's no question it's going to be changed. There's no doubt about that. We've all read the stories about certain players who had come into our marketplace here in the United States looking to take a pretty serious risk in joining, you know, either a shale play or an unconventional play. Many of the players were highly leveraged. I think it's fair to say that you'll see some of those players go by the wayside. They may be purchased by larger players in the marketplace. They may just simply close up shop and go by the wayside. That's the free market system. It's the way it works here in the United States. But I have no doubt that in a few months or perhaps, 6 months, we're going to see our industry almost back to where it was pre-pandemic levels. And that assumes, of course, we open up the economy. So, I was just told earlier today, as a matter of fact, as we looked at some of the data that, roughly 25 or 26 states that comprise about 41% of the U.S. demand are open for business today. So if that trend continues, if that happens over the course of the next 60 days, I think you're going to see the U.S. energy industry bounce right back. These are some very strong players, and importantly, they're very innovative players. And I'm reminded of a comment that one of the energy ministers told me in the G20 conversation. He said, every time we do something like this, everybody thinks that the United States is going to leave the playing field. The United States is dead, or a certain part of the industry is dead, and that never really happens. They take a small break and they come back stronger than ever. And I do think that's going to happen again.
Are we seeing, are you keeping track of the shut-ins that are happening in, across the industry?
Yes, we are. And we're, concerned about that. As I mentioned, some of these players are not going to come back. So these wells are being shut in and perhaps permanently. I'm not really sure exactly at this point what the numbers are. But, we are seeing some of that activity. But we're also seeing some very rational economic behavior occur in the marketplace as well. Some folks are simply shutting production. If they have a strong balance sheet, they prefer to sell their product at some point in the future where they may get a better price for it. So we're seeing some slowed production as a result of, as I said, very rational economic behavior.
Tell us about the administration's initiatives and plans in terms of basically making liquidity available to this industry as it's being made available to other industries.
Sure. So what we've done, I've worked closely at the president's direction. I've worked closely with Secretary Mnuchin over at the U.S. Secretary of Treasury. And we've had some really good conversations about ensuring that the programs that have been passed by Congress, the CARES Act, other programs that have been passed by Congress in order to provide liquidity to all industries across our economy, have ensured that, the energy industry is not discriminated against or excluded from these types of programs. And the secretary has been great to work with. And just recently, last week, as a matter of fact, we were able to extend eligibility to the energy industry to what is known as the Main Street Lending Program. And, you know, that will provide for especially the what we refer to as the mid-cap players, the people right in the middle of the industry. It's not the investment grade companies, although they have access to other programs should they choose to avail themselves to them. And it's not really the folks who are probably going to exit the business anyway, perhaps close to insolvency. But it's really that middle category of player, very strong companies, very good technologies, very good at what they do, but simply facing an extraordinary time given the lack of demand. And our intent is to provide them with liquidity so that, again, they can make it beyond this pandemic period and come back on the other side stronger than ever.
Is that part of the Main Street program or is that an additional program?
No, it's called the Main Street Lending Program. It's part of what the Congress passed. And what we simply did was to ensure that the requirements were not so restrictive that they might exclude oil and gas producers in the United States. So we sort of opened up the eligibility to ensure that these companies could qualify should they choose to use it.
Right. And is that program one in which they then go to their local, to their banker and they do it?
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And is that up and running now?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Companies. Right.
Yeah, this was announced very recent. It was announced last week. So it's a very new development in the marketplace.
I'm glad that we could bring it to the fore then. Thanks. Mm-hmm. What do you think, obviously the DOE thinks and works and focuses on resilience and energy resilience. Do you see some lessons from the COVID crisis for energy resilience for this country?
Yes, we do. You probably have read about the supply chain issues that exist in the medical field. We're looking at that as well in the oil and gas field, as well as the electricity field. The president just announced last week, as a matter of fact, in the new executive order, directing me to organize a task force with our U.S. Department of Defense, Department of Commerce, Department of State, and others to look at the supply chain around the provision of bulk power, bulk electricity power. We're very concerned about some of the supply chain issues that we have seen raised as part of this pandemic. It's amazing, Dan, you wouldn't think of it, but we do have adversaries, and sometimes they will avail themselves of these types of opportunities to take advantage of what they perceive to be shortfalls in our supply chain or our national infrastructure.
Without going into sensitive areas, can you be a little more specific about what the concerns are about resilience in the power sector?
Sure. Well, with regard to the electricity sector, I mean, we've identified some technologies and some pieces of equipment that are being used to transfer data back to some of our nations, some of the nations that, you know, quite literally don't have our interest in mind or don't have our interest at heart. And we've identified this equipment and we've been in the process of notifying utilities in particular of this dangerous situation within their grid. You know, using these types of technologies, especially when we're talking about bulk power, I'm not talking about the distribution network or the last mile of wire, you know, from your local utility to your home. I'm talking about large transmission assets that, you know, if damaged or if sidelined or if tampered with, you know, could turn off the lights in a major part of a large city, perhaps shut down the power to some of our oil and gas producing facilities around the world. So around the country, I should say. So, you know, that's a very real concern for us here at the department, and we're moving very aggressively to address them.
Right. Will you be looking at supply chain issues, which may be of a different nature for the oil and gas industry that have come out of this crisis or more generally?
Yeah. I think as a government, we will look at it. I've not been advised of any particular supply chain issues, at least with regard to oil and gas. You know, the materials that are used there tend to be, you know, very, very, I don't want to say basic, but, you know, lots of steel, lots of, you know, basic infrastructure. So the technologies are typically different than the ones what we see in the electricity space. The reason the electricity is such a concern for us is that, you know, especially now as we're trying to telework and today we're doing this meeting virtually, imagine doing it without electricity. It'd be impossible. So we're very concerned about that.
You mentioned infrastructure. A continuing issue is, of course, pipelines and being able to build pipelines,
sure.
Both within the United States and our relationship with Canada. Do you see progress on that, being able to overcome some of these obstacles that get drawn out over years and years?
Sure. Well, I think the passage of the USMCA, I think, goes a long way to alleviating some of the obstacles for the development of infrastructure across our borders. And that's both with Canada and Mexico as well. So I look forward to, you know, furthering those types of opportunities as part of this important trade pact. But also the Canadian minister, Minister Seamus Reagan, and I have had many conversations about how do we get together. He's somewhat new in his role. I'm somewhat new in my role, at least in the secretary's role. How do we get together and coordinate our activities at moving forward? And we've already begun those conversations, so I look forward to continuing them. But we're also taking some very basic steps here within our geographic borders. You know, you may have read in the papers or may have read in the open source materials about some of our regulatory efforts around NEPA and reforming the NEPA process to ensure that there aren't redundancies in the system that may slow down the development of these important infrastructure projects. As we've talked about in the past, we've, you know, almost fixed the production problem, you know, that we used to have as a country. We became the world's largest producer of oil and gas. Our challenge today is getting the product to market. It's moving it across state boundaries. It's moving it across, you know, to our national boundaries and getting it onto the open water for export. And that's really the challenge that we all face as Americans, and we're going to be working very hard to fix those issues.
Well, Mr. Secretary, we started talking about the DOE labs. Maybe we'll circle back now at the end to that as well. Mm-hmm. As you said, the Department of Energy is also the Department of Science. And maybe just talk a little bit about the DOE's innovation agenda and the areas that you're excited about.
Well, I tell you, you know, it's DOE is often called the Department of Everything because we do a little bit of everything here. And it's a really fascinating place to work. But, you know, in this particular area with the production of oil and gas, I'm very excited about what I see in some of the upcoming work in the laboratories. And, you know, I think in the very near future, we're going to fix some of the challenges we faced around technologies involving, for instance, hydraulic fracturing. We're on the cusp of developing technologies that will, it's a desalination process that will take the salt and take the chemicals out of the water that's used as part of the fracking process. And we can return that water either to a body of water cleaner than which we took it from, or give it back to the industry for reuse in a fracking operation or perhaps other operations. We're very, very close to solving that important problem. And again, it's just, I think, yet another example of the type of work that's being done in our science laboratories all throughout the Department of Energy.
Of course, you're also working at frontiers of new energy. What's tops for you as you think about it? I mean, I know it's a long list, but.
Yeah, it's hard. It's, you know, it's a very exciting place to work, Dan. I mean, I'm excited about what I see in the future for things like battery storage. I think we're on the cusp of perhaps solving, you know, what is known as grid scale battery storage. You know, if we were to blue sky this conversation, I can foresee a day in which we can transport electricity without wires and without transmission networks. And that's an exciting world in which to live. I mean, we just talked about some of the challenges we face with adversaries who might destroy or attempt to destroy or, you know, somehow degrade our transmission networks. So what if we lived in a world in which there were no transmission networks and you could turn the lights on without wires? It's a bit futuristic, but we're trying to figure it out here at the U.S. Department of Energy.
Well, I think that's a very good place to wind up the conversation, because certainly we can see solving the, you know, the desalinization, working on that. But I think you've all opened everybody's minds to things that are beyond tomorrow, but maybe not too far beyond tomorrow with the skill and capabilities of the lab. Secretary Brouillette, thank you very much for taking this time for this CERAWeek conversation. I've been talking with Secretary of Energy Dan Brouillette. We've talked about how the Department of Energy is addressing the COVID crisis and the contribution it's making, the turmoil in the oil market, and some of the measures that the administration, U.S. government, is taking to relieve those pressures and get us back on a solid foundation, and of course, the longer-term achievements and possibilities that come out of this department and the great laboratories and the people who work in it. So thank you for joining us for this conversation. And again, thank you very much, Secretary Bruyette.
Thank you, Dan.